Welcome back to Robbinsdale Revisited, the podcast where we pull back the layers of our town's history to discover the people, places, and strange little quirks that made Robbinsdale what it is today. I'm Crystal Boyd, a member of the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
And I'm Pete Ritchie, the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society. If you've spent any time in Lakeview Terrace Park or strolling around the Crystal Lake Boardwalk, you've probably noticed that except for the occasional baseball game, it's relatively quiet. But if you could jump into a time machine with my dog Peabody and I and fly back about 100 years, you'd find a community absolutely buzzing with industrial energy, local weather flags, a booming resort, and some fiercely passionate radical politics.
Today, we're telling the sprawling multi-generational saga of the Nash family. They were a family that really did it all, from fighting in the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, to running for governor on a socialist ticket, to revolutionizing local firefighting, and even giving the region its ultimate summer playground.
And this isn't just a story about one family. It's a window into the great populist and socialist movements that swept across the Midwest in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So grab a cup of coffee, settle in, and let's take a trip back to old Crystal Lake Township.
Our story really begins with the patriarch of the family. His name was J. Elijah Nash, and Jay wasn't originally a Minnesotan. He was born out on the East Coast on March 29th, 1843, out east in Hadley, Massachusetts. He was just 18 years old when the nation fractured and the Civil War broke out. Jay stepped up, enlisted in the Union Army with Company D of the 27th Regiment, Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry.
And he didn't see just a little bit of action, Crystal. He was right in the thick of it. Jay re-enlisted in 1863 and fought a staggering 20 battles over the course of the war. He rose to the rank of sergeant, was wounded in action during the bloody siege of Petersburg in 1864, and was even captured by Confederate forces in North Carolina. In 1865, he spent a grueling 19 days as a prisoner of war before a prisoner exchange finally set him free.
And if we really think about the impacts of war on people and their mental health, you just have to imagine how that kind of intense, sustained trauma shapes a young man. When the war ended, Jay went back to Massachusetts. He married a young woman from Springfield named Martha Davis. And like so many veterans looking for a fresh start, they cast their eyes westward. In 1869, they packed up and moved to Minnesota, initially settling in Minneapolis.
Right, and in 1874, Martha gave birth to their first son, George S. Nash. A few years later, in 1880, Jay made a move that would define his family's legacy for nearly a century. He purchased 40 acres of land in what was then known as Crystal Lake Township.
And if you're trying to picture where this was located, Jay's farm was massive. It extended from 38th and 40th Avenues north, stretching all the way from Xerxes Avenue right down to the eastern shore of Crystal Lake. He established a dairy farm there and built a giant 100-foot barn and managed a herd of 82 cattle.
But Jay had a restless mind. He didn't want to just milk cows. In 1886, he diversified and opened up a hardware and tin shop over on Washington Avenue. Around this time, his personal life went through some big shifts. He and Martha divorced, and in 1886, he remarried a Vermont native named Clara Louise Cooper. Together, Jay and Clara had two more children, a son named Floyd, born in 1890, and a daughter named Ruby, born in 1895.
And remember Ruby, we're going to come back to her in just a little bit. But for now, let's talk a little bit more about Jay's creative mind. Because while he was tending to his cows and selling hardware, he was spending a vast amount of time reflecting on his days as a Union soldier. He came to a really interesting conclusion for a war hero. He decided that war was nothing more than organized murder. He became a dedicated pacifist, and he realized that to achieve true peace, you have to change the underlying economic system. He became convinced that socialism was the answer.
And this is where our story expands into the broader history of Minnesota, because people today don't always realize how radical Midwestern politics used to be. Around the turn of the century, the Midwest was a hotbed for populist movements, cooperative farming networks, labor unions, and farmers felt squeezed by railroad monopolies and big banks, and workers were always fighting just for basic safety.
Yeah, exactly. And in 1899, J. Elijah Nash became one of the literal founders of the Social Democratic Party of Minnesota. By 1902, he was so highly regarded within the movement that they selected him as the Socialist Party's nominee for governor of Minnesota. He only won less than 1% of the vote, but it put him on the map.
Then came the election of 1904, and this brings up a really fascinating piece of Minnesota political trivia. Jay ran for governor again, but if you looked at the ballot, you wouldn't see the word socialist next to his name. Why? Because Minnesota passed a restrictive law aimed at keeping the word socialist off of official ballots.
Very sneaky. Just leave it to the establishment politicians of the era to try some sneaky branding laws. To get around it, the party rebranded itself on the ballot as the Public Ownership Party of Minnesota. And Jay became the state secretary of the Public Ownership Party. And in 1904, he took another shot at the governor's race, bumping his numbers up slightly to nearly 2%.
2% of the vote. Good work, Jay. Under Jay's leadership as state secretary, the party exploded in 1905. They had fewer than 800 dues-paying members in good standing. By 1908, the number more than doubled to 1,800. And by 1915, it topped out at 5,600 members. They started winning local elections, capturing mayoral seats up in Brainerd, Two Harbors, Crookston, and Bemidji, and even electing a member to the state legislature. I only wish the Robbinsdale Historical Society could grow our membership from, 800 to 1,800 to 5,600.
We'll get there, Pete. We're working on it. And we actually have an incredible newspaper excerpt from the Minneapolis Journal in 1908. It paints a picture of what the party conventions were really like. The headline noted a two-day convention, resulting in a platform that included everything delegates could think of, and then some.
Right, and then some. Classic political conventions. The article explicitly mentions Jay Nash, noting the party decided to only run 5 candidates for state offices instead of a full ticket because filing fees were $50 a candidate. Jay told the crowd, "The party has got to pay these fees, and when we pay for 5, we've paid enough. Pragmatic socialism at its finest."
I really love that. The paper also noted that they added a specific liquor traffic regulation plank to the platform, which was done entirely at the urging of the many Finnish immigrants who made up a huge backbone of the socialist movement in Minnesota. Jay took his message to the speaker's circuit, traveling all over the state. He ran for state treasurer in 1912, where he won a massive 12.65% of the vote, and again in 1914.
But Jay's political rise came to a sudden and tragic halt on July 30th, 1915. At 72 years of age, Jay was heading home from work when he was thrown from his wagon and killed. It was a massive blow to the community, but Jay passed on his relentless work ethic and his civic pride to his children.
Now, let's pivot just a little bit. We're going to chat about Jay's oldest son, George Silas Nash, and his family. While his father, Jay, was fighting political battles on the state stage, George was focusing entirely on building up his own household and the infrastructure of Robbinsdale. In 1900, George married Agnes Scott. Agnes was actually an immigrant herself, born on June 10, 1881, in Pokesdown, Christchurch, Hampshire, England, to Henry George and Elizabeth Louise Scott.
So George and Agnes had a long life together, but it wasn't without some deep heartbreak. They were the parents of 4 children, but tragically, 2 of them never made it to adulthood. Their daughter, Viola A. Nash, was born in 1903, but died in childhood around the age of 4. And in 1905, they lost an infant son, Chester M. Nash, who passed away the same year he was born. Both are resting peacefully alongside Agnes and George today in Mound Cemetery out in western Hennepin County.
And it's really a reminder of how fragile life was back then. They did have 2 surviving children, George Jr. and Evelyn Olive, and they grew up to be incredible civic mainstays. But in December 1904, the Minneapolis Morning Tribune noted that George Sr. had opened up a shop for tin, sheet metal jobbing, and furnace work in a room just south of J.A. Roth's general store.
The paper explicitly called George an expert mechanic and trusted that he would bring up a good business. Boy, were they right. In 1907, George had built a brand new building just south of the original spot right on West Broadway near 40th. And this was the famous Nash Hardware.
The famous Nash Hardware. There is a beautiful, bold advertisement from the June 28, 1914 issue of the Minneapolis Tribune. The header reads, George S. Nash Plumbing, and boasts services for hot air, hot water, and steam heating, alongside hardware, tin, sheet metal, and pump work. George was the local agent for massive national brands like Foreman Ford's 100% Pure Paint, National Mazda Lamps, Florence Oil Stoves, and Storm King Boilers.
Let's talk about his most charming role. George was the unofficial village weatherman. He had a custom weather flags rigged up right above Nash Hardware. Every morning, George would call up the Minneapolis Weather Bureau and get official predictions, and then he would signal the daily forecast to the entire town using a system of various colored flags.
I think that's so cool. I wish we still got our weather through various colored flags.
Yeah, you know, we got a picture of this. And somebody's out on Crystal Lake, and you can actually see the hardware store and the flag run up over there on West Broadway.
What color did they use for tornado?
Black.
Besides being a weatherman, George was also a pioneer in bringing modern utilities to town. In 1931, when Robbinsdale residents finally began connecting to a modern sewer system, which is a big deal out on this side of the county, the very first public place to secure a permit was the Sacred Heart School. And who did the town trust to do the engineering and execute that critical work? George Nash Sr.
But George wasn't just plumbing and predicting the weather. He was protecting the village. He was deeply involved in the volunteer fire department and served as fire chief for many years. In 1893, the village was newly incorporated. Firefighting was a scrappy affair. In 1908, George stepped up to ensure that these brave volunteer fighters were taken care of, and he, alongside of other local leaders, officially penned the Articles of Incorporation for the Robbinsdale Fire Department Relief Association.
And the goal was clear and vital: to give immediate financial aid to disabled firemen, defray funeral expenses, and secure pensions for volunteers who dedicated years of their lives to the safety of Robbinsdale. And there were a lot of fires here, so there really was a need for it.
Now, George's legacy didn't stop with him. His son, George Nash Jr., was born right here in Robbinsdale on November 16, 1901. He received his education locally before heading off to the prestigious Dunwoody Institute in Minneapolis and later the University of Southern Minnesota in Austin.
George Jr. was incredibly driven. He became a sales representative for Simmons Hardware out of Minneapolis, but he also proudly worked alongside his father in the family plumbing and heating business right on West Broadway. He was deeply involved in the community's spiritual backbone, too, acting as a charter member in forming the Baptist Church of Robbinsdale and serving as a deacon of the Fourth Baptist Church of Minneapolis.
In 1931, George Jr. married Dorothy Douglas of Detroit Lakes. Eventually, in 1957, they moved up to Detroit Lakes permanently, where George Jr. entered the real estate business until his retirement. He passed away at the age of 84, October 15, 1985, leaving behind a deep lineage of civic duty.
Now, while George Sr. and Jr. were keeping everyone warm, safe, and appraised of the weather, George Sr.'s younger half-brother, Floyd E. Nash, was looking at the natural crown jewel of the town, Crystal Lake.
You know, the relationship between Robbinsdale and Crystal Lake has always been complicated. Back in the 1880s, West Broadway was actually called Crystal Lake Avenue, and the farmers used it to haul produce to Minneapolis. The hill on the west side of the lake was so steep, and horse carts would get stuck in this muddy, massive mess, and caravans, sometimes 20 deep, would be backed up along Crystal Lake Hill. In 1893, the newly formed village council actually used $1,000 from the local saloon fund to cut down the hill, and they dumped the dirt right into the water, which actually shrank the size of Crystal Lake.
Despite that, the lake was incredibly pristine at that time. In the 1890s, companies like the Robbinsdale Ice and Fuel Company, started by William Randall and George Don Johnson, began harvesting ice. Sioux and the Crystal Ice Company and Cedar Lake Ice Company joined in. In 1903, the local newspaper reported that because of the extreme clearness and purity, Crystal Lake Ice was considered the absolute best you could get around Minneapolis. The town's founder, Andrew B. Robbins, even claimed Crystal Lake would one day rival Minneapolis's famous Lake Harriet.
Yep, that was his hope. He hoped to sell big fancy homes on big fancy lots. It was that pristine reputation that inspired Floyd Nash to open up his public bathhouse on the lakeshore in 1916. I'm looking at these vintage ads we have from 1919, and you can see that this place was an immediate sensation, offering swimming, boating, refreshments, cigars, and even lively Sunday afternoon and evening dances. Visitors came from Minneapolis and were told to take the Chicago Penn streetcar right to the end of the line, and then just walk a few blocks over to the water.
By 1923, Floyd had upgraded the facility to feature massive wooden toboggan slides, diving springboards, and water teeter-totters. The ads proudly boomed that the water tested 100% pure for bathing by the Board of Health, and that they sterilized every suit and towel after use.
In 1924, the faculty boasted 1,000 lockers and the incredible claim that the beach had never suffered a single drowning in its 10 years of operation. It was affordable, clean, and safe. They even added cash prize fishing contests in 1927, offering a whopping $65 in prizes for the best catches.
Oh, but the glory days hit a wall. Drought and the Great Depression forced the baths to close in 1933. Floyd pivoted and built 16 rental cottages around the lake, but the environment was changing. During the Depression, more of the northwest portion of the lake was filled in, which caused the water quality to rapidly deteriorate.
You know, even wilder, the area was plagued by deep peat fires. The peat was buried 10 to 12 feet underground, and firefighters would completely douse the area with water, only to find the ground smoking and burning again the very next day.
Now, Pete, we have to talk about the 30-cent swimsuit rental for a second, because renting a swimsuit in the 1920s wasn't just a matter of convenience, it was a matter of morals. And honey, things on the shoreline were starting to get a little bit heated.
Yeah, that's right. We're talking about the height of the Prohibition era. While people were secretly defying the government to get a drink, local authorities were hyper-focused on a completely different crisis. Exactly how much bare, sun-kissed leg women were flashing at the beach.
It's so wild to think about. This was the scandalous era of bathing suit police. And in some cities, the beach censors would patrol the public shores with actual measuring tapes to ensure a woman's swimsuit didn't dare sit more than 6 inches above her knee. If you defied the dress code and showed a little too much thigh, you could be fined or straight up arrested for indecent exposure.
What?
Can you imagine Floyd Nash dealing with this at Crystal Baths? You've got 900 people flocking to Robbinsdale from the big city on a scorching July weekend. The jazz music is pumping, bodies are close, people are sneaking flasks of moonshine into the picnic grounds, whiz-bang magazines are hiding underneath towels, and meanwhile, someone's grandma is hyperventilating because a gorgeous young flapper has rolled her stockings down, leaving her knee completely naked.
A knee! Oh my goodness! And for the swimsuits, the fabric itself was an absolute battlefield. The 1920s was right when women were finally tossing aside those heavy, suffocating, multi-layered flannel bathing gowns made out of flannel. They honestly looked more like wool tents than anything else. They clung to you like wet cement. They were literally a drowning hazard. And the women were trading those in for something much more provocative: form-fitting, knitted wool one-piece suits.
Oh, knitted wool swimsuits from that era became heavy, and they clung to the body when wet, offering little coverage and revealing more than intended. It hugged every single curve and caused a massive generational divide. The older crowd saw these tight, soggy wool numbers as the literal moral decay of society. But for the youth, the flaming youth, it was all about liberation, showing off some skin, athleticism, and honestly, just wanting to look good drying off in the same century you were swimming in.
Right? I mean, Floyd's had to walk this fine line, so his ad explicitly promised good, clean, wholesome fun, so he had to keep things, like, just respectable enough to keep the town's conservative elements from shutting him down, while still letting the youth flaunt what they had on those giant water toboggan slides.
Yeah, it was a delicate but thrilling balancing act, policing the hemlines by day and ignoring the heavily spiked punch bowls and whatever else was happening in the shadows of the beach by night.
But what happens at Crystal Baths stays at Crystal Baths. Speaking of the family members who observed all this changing culture from the shores, let's talk a little bit about Floyd's sister, Ruby. We don't know what kind of swimsuit she wore, but she lived out her days on the historic 1880 family farmhouse on Abbott Avenue. While developers tore down the old homestead in July 1964 to build modern Ramblers, the lake itself was going through an even more drastic destruction.
While her brothers were busy building up Robbinsdale, Ruby Nash remained the keeper of the original family homestead. She was an absolute force, highly independent, incredibly bright, and a dedicated teacher at North High School in Minneapolis. Looking back at her 1914 North High yearbook, back then all the kids from Robbinsdale went to North High because we didn't have a high school here. Anyway, her class motto declares that she did her own thinking and needed little advice.
That's amazing. And she really did. In fact, her 1914 class prophecy took a wild sci-fi turn. They used to write these little prophecies for the graduates. Hers predicted that one day on Mars, in the City of Patience, Ruby would become the editor of the only socialist journal on the planet, meriting high honors from prominent editors back on Earth.
From North High to the Red Planet. Anyway, back here on Earth, she ruled over a massive 10-room wooden farmhouse built by her father back in 1880 on the east side of Crystal Lake. In the 1940s, the area was still surrounded by wide open land and small cottages. Abbott Avenue stopped right at 39th, and it was a straight shot from her place to the water. Neighbor kids used her massive field and steep hill for sledding. Everyone around here just called it Ruby Hill.
We have some great local memories that were shared online, and the neighborhood kids were a little bit terrified of her at first because she would burn sections of the grass that helps to renew the growth. And when she did that, she would contain the flames just using a water-soaked burlap bag. And to a kid, that looked pretty wild. So rumors flew that she was a scary witch. But that illusion shattered the moment someone actually met her.
Exactly. Neighbors remember her inviting the brave tree-climbing kids inside for tea, where she would show off old photos, including a fascinating one of a little boy dressed as a girl. That was pretty common in the Victorian era. Others remember the house was filled with so many plants it felt like a greenhouse. One local recalled wandering into the woods behind the property and meeting Ruby's young niece, and she was invited inside to a warm, friendly welcome, and the niece quietly complained that Ruby made her eat stale cereal for breakfast.
But that was a Depression-era mindset. Waste not, want not. But change was coming fast to the lakeside. By the mid-1940s, larger modern homes were being built right across the street, and they were replacing the old fields where neighborhood kids used to build forts and jump on the bogs.
The final transition came in July of 1964. We have a bittersweet photo and a clipping from the Minneapolis Star showing a massive crane demolishing the historic Nash farmhouse. It was at 3854 Abbott Avenue North to make way for a new development of 8 mid-century Ramblers and split levels. Ruby was 70 at the time and relocated to Brooklyn Center, where she lived until she passed away in 1968 at the age of 74. In 1959, Robbinsdale approved a bond to develop a park on the marshy south side of the lake, and they had this contest. You could win a free bicycle if you came up with the best name for the park. A kid named Greg Hollenkamp called it Lakeview Terrace Park, and that was the winner of the city contest.
They had spent 2 years hauling in fill dirt for the lake, and sadly, that massive amount of fill dirt severely choked the lake. By 1967, Crystal Lake was officially declared a dead lake. The ecosystem was devastated.
But Robbinsdale didn't give up. In 1973, they launched an aggressive restoration project. They installed aeration pumps and literally used helicopters to spray bentonite, a volcanic clay, directly into the water to seal the lake bed. The very next year, Shoreline Park was dedicated and the lake successfully was restocked with northern pike, walleye, and bluegills.
It's been a continuous battle ever since. The lake was placed on the impaired waters list in 2002 because of high phosphorus levels. To save it, the city built rain gardens and pollutant traps. And in 2012, they installed the high-tech Crystal Lake Flocculation Plant on the south side. And that plant treats the water with alum from May to November. That helps to clear out the phosphorus, and then they pump clean water back into the beautiful lake.
To bring our saga full circle, you know, the end of Crystal Lake and sort of the end of the Nash family in Robbinsdale, let's head out west to the family's final resting place.
When George Sr. passed away in 1946, followed by Ruby in 1968, an entire era of frontier builders, weathermen, and socialist secretariats drew to a close. The physical footprint of the Nash dairy pastures became the neat grids of modern Robbinsdale, but the impact of the Nash family is everywhere.
So the next time you take a walk along the eastern shore of Crystal Lake, look out at Lakeview Terrace Park and check the weather on your phone. Think of the Nash family, the volunteer firefighters, and the crystal baths of Robbinsdale's past.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. In the bus back home, sitting hand in hand. When the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.
Oh, yeah.